third of the restaurants that we visited this past weekend were not in compliance. Their employees were not, in fact, appropriately protected. And that was also covered with even more of the sites where the distancing measurements were also not in effect.
LA County Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer speaking to ABC 7 about restaurants not complying with public health guidelines last weekend. Well, now restaurants have been shut down again for inside dining. That's because we're seeing an alarming spread of coronavirus cases in California. Yesterday, there were nearly 5,900 new cases statewide, about a third of them here in LA County. The number of people hospitalized in the state has also risen dramatically. We're going to talk about how Southern California is responding to this surge with LA County Supervisor Sheila Kuehl. Welcome.
Thank you. Lovely to be here. We're here is kind of in quotes these days.
Yeah, exactly. Well, lovely to have you on the show. And we spoke with your colleague, Supervisor Catherine Barger, several weeks ago, and she justified reopening at the time, saying we need to get the economy up and open again, and she would hate to see us have to turn back the clock, and there was no appetite to do so. So knowing what we know now, and given that this recent surge started after the Memorial Day weekend, so about a month ago, did LA County reopen too quickly and too much?
Yes and no. I mean, the thing that I think people don't understand is that the United States is not a country that worries about taking care of every person in it. It's always been more kind of like every man for himself. You don't have an underpinning for people's income like some Western European countries do. So your job is it. And what we were seeing after the major shutdown is 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 cars lined up for food giveaways. People frightened because they didn't know how were they supposed to go to the market and buy food when they had no revenue. Their health insurance wasn't kicking in when they weren't working. Everyone was really frightened. So we thought, you know, we have got to help people get back to work. It wasn't just about, can you go and get a drink in a bar? It was about people working in bars and restaurants, people working in shops. So we said, okay, we are willing to open this up, and these are the very strict rules. And as you just heard Barbara say, they didn't follow them. So the people in LA County flunked. They flunked. They weren't wearing masks. They weren't doing social distancing. So we have to go backwards.
So what does that mean? Do you have to get out there and fine people if they don't wear a mask? I believe in West Hollywood, they're actually going to do that. They're going to fine people hundreds of dollars if they're not wearing a mask, $300. Is that something that needs to happen?
Absolutely. Now, I don't know about the mask fines for individuals, but I'm bringing a motion on Tuesday to establish the ability to fine every business not in compliance, and the second time to shut them down. Because I think they have to take it much more seriously. You go into a bar and everybody's sitting next to each other on the stools without masks. Well, what are you thinking? Now, that means that we have to have enough people to go out and inspect. And of course, since government has been starved over the past two decades, we are going to do our very best. So we were relying on a lot of income from sales, which of course are not happening as well. So we were hopefully going to be helped by the cities, and the governor is asking them all, whenever you go to inspect anything, you know, a construction site, tell us. If the guys aren't wearing masks, pull the permit.
Right. So that leaves the enforcement up to the individual business owner, right? The store owner, the restaurant owner, the bar owner. They've got to police their customers.
Yes and no. I mean, we're still going to be inspecting. The way that Barbara knows 49% of the bars were not doing physical distancing is that they go out and, you know, rate them. And the way she knew that workers were not wearing face masks at 45% of the restaurants is they go out and they inspect them. And we're going to do that more than ever.
Do you have enough inspectors to do that?
No. It's a great big county, and we don't. That's why we're going to ask for help from the cities and possibly be able to spend some of our CARES Act money for inspection. Because if we don't, the numbers are just going to go up and up.
So there's no plan being discussed about shutting everything down completely?
No, there is no plan being discussed about shutting everything down. You know, we never did. Obviously, the markets stay open, the pharmacies stay open. you know, there were a number of essential businesses that had to operate straight through. But it's possible, not yet happening, to say people can't go to malls anymore, you know, sort of unraveling what the governor did. We followed the governor in each case because so many of our cities are so close to other counties that we wanted to be in sync as much as possible.
Well, Barbara Ferrer did say that she felt some pressure to reopen because other counties were doing that. And it's kind of hard to say to the public, oh, well, you can't go to a bar here, but you can go to a bar there. Do you think the governor failed in not providing a uniform set of restrictions and letting the counties make up their own rules?
Well, he didn't let the counties make up their own rules, except where they were more stringent. When he makes a statewide directive, it applies to all 58 counties. So when he said yesterday, no indoor restaurant dining, that applies to all 58 counties, I think.
No, it only applies to the counties that are in a risky state. So 19 counties.
Well, you know, I think he thinks that's fair. And you know how America is about fairness. Look, my county's doing fine. I'm Butte County and I only have 2 cases. You know, don't make me shut everything down. So to wend your way through the economic burdens that are caused by COVID and the health burdens caused by COVID, I think it's not easy. So I think it's easy to say government should have done this or should not have done this. But I think if you had a vote, you'd find it almost 50-50 on almost everything. So we're trying to be as stringent as we can while recognizing the economic problems. And now in LA County, we're going to go backwards with the governor.
Right. And the order is for these businesses to be closed for 3 weeks or so.
Yes, but I think, you know, we're going to have to go longer than that. I mean, there's just no question. So I think people should prepare to go longer.
Longer than 3 weeks? Like how much longer?
I don't know. I have to look at the numbers every day. You know, if our cases stay above 2,000 a day, then I'm not going back on the 4th week.
Right. However, the end of July is when the extra bump in unemployment benefits runs out.
Well, that's the problem that we've had with the federal government all along, is we are not getting the kind of support for people that we need. And so people become very frightened. They say, I have to go back to work. They disobey the orders, you know, they open surreptitiously, they let their customers know, come on in, you know, nobody's looking. And that has been a total failure of the federal government to give us the kind of support we needed. We're just scrambling to try to take care of all the cases that are arising. And I think we're doing a pretty good job. I mean, people are working their butts off, you know, Madeline, and it's not impossible. But I'd say we have done very well, but it's a hard road to walk between the economic disaster and the health disaster.
Yeah. What about the testing problem? Several testing sites are going to be closed over the weekend because of the holiday. It's difficult to get appointments in some public testing sites. Why isn't the county increasing testing?
Well, it's difficult now to get them when they're, you know, when they're open, because a lot of people want tests just because they want tests. And the test costs $175 each. And there are plenty of test kits available. We're trying to limit them to people with symptoms or, you know, people over 65 or people who are underlying illnesses. And we want people to start going to their own physicians and the insurance companies to cover it, because we will not be able to provide tests for all 10 million people in the county.
Although Mayor Garcetti said anyone who wants a test can get one. So is there some mixed messaging going on?
It's mixed because the city has its own idea about it. The county will not provide tests to everybody who wants one. And so our county sites never did. They want to know, are you showing symptoms? Why do you want a test? People who don't even contact their own physicians, and, you know, most people are insured and, you know, fighting with the insurance companies who say that, well, we don't want to pay for tests. So the county, I think, has taken the right middle ground, but it's overwhelmed on our website as well.
Well, thank you for joining us today.
You bet. It's always a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for what you do.
Well, thank you. LA County Supervisor Sheila Kuehl. how restaurants are coping with this whiplash of opening and closing, opening and closing. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The new round of restrictions here in California is causing whiplash for some restaurant owners. Restaurants had been allowed to reopen just over a week ago. Now, inside dining in most Southern California counties is shut down for at least 3 weeks. Joining me now is Gabriel Gordon, owner of Beachwood Barbecue in Seal Beach and Beachwood Barbecue and Brewing in Long Beach. Hi, Gabe.
Hi, Madeline. How are you today?
I am fine, thank you. Also joining us is Greg Amsler, owner of Salt Creek Grill in Valencia. Hi, Greg.
How you doing, Madeline? Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you both. So I guess you guys have been trying to figure out how to safely reopen, and now you have to close indoor dining at least for 3 weeks. What did you think when you first heard that news, Gabe?
I wasn't surprised, but I mean, it was completely devastating as our other locations other than our Seal Beach had literally just opened within a few days earlier. So
Wow. It
was not a pleasant announcement.
So your other location being in Long Beach?
Yeah, Long Beach. Then we have a couple tasting rooms in Orange County as well, but they are also got tied up in that order. So they were actually shut down completely. For dine-in service, even though we are outdoors in those places.
And Greg, what about you?
Well, once they, I kind of felt the same way as Gabe. Once the bars were closed, and then we found out that Governor Newsom was going to make a large announcement yesterday. As soon as we found that out, I kind of saw the writing on the wall. And I guess in the back of my mind, I was kind of mentally preparing for it. And the question was, was it going to be complete shutdown like we used to be, where it'd be takeout only, mm-hmm. or if we were going to be able to do some semblance of dine-in service?
So it's complete shutdown of indoor dining. Do you have any outdoor dining, Greg?
We're fortunate. We have a large outdoor patio, which we expanded, about 2005, 2006. We actually have an outside bar there also with about 20 tables. We also have a fire pit that was kind of a waiting area where you could have some cocktails or a glass of wine while you're waited. Obviously, there's no waiting area anymore, so we pulled out all of the benches and put in temporary tables around the fire pit, so we were able to kind of pick up some of the lost tables we had that we lost on the main patio because of the physical distancing.
So it doesn't sound devastating for you. You can remain open.
Yeah, we can remain open. We're probably about 30% of capacity, I guess, at this point.
What about you, Gabe?
Our Long Beach location has a large outdoor patio that we had opened back up for dine-in on Thursday. We were incredibly cautious about reopening any of our facilities for dine-in. The guidance was mediocre at best from all levels of government, and it was of the utmost importance that we went above and beyond what was required or even suggested. So it took us quite a while, but we are at, I would say, 20% capacity of our overall restaurant.
What about Seal Beach?
Yeah, so Seal Beach is done. We announced yesterday, and that was the store that started everything for my wife and I and our entire little Beachwood empire, if you'll allow us to use that that term. Uh-huh. That store is a tiny little store that's actually made up of two skinny hallways, essentially. That are only 11 feet wide on each side. There was no outdoor dining for us in the city. And the safest that we could open that with social distancing guidelines was to have three tables. And even with three tables, we could not have kept our staff safe. They would have needed to be in full hazmat suits, essentially, to be safe. So that was not an option. A week or so ago, the city actually did allow some forms of sidewalk and outdoor dining. It would have only added about 5 tables for us based on their restrictions. You know, for 8 tables, which is less than 50% of our capacity, it wouldn't have ever been worth it to put my staff or my loyal customer base in harm's way.
So when you say done, does that mean done?
Yeah, we're closing up.
Finished forever?
Yeah, finished forever. So we'll be closing at the end of this month. Our lease was coming up, and it was how do you justify re-signing up for a lease in the midst of a pandemic? Like, we don't know when a vaccine's going to come. We don't know when these restrictions are going to open and close, and you can't have a tiny little restaurant and do anything safely. It's just, they are completely mutually exclusive.
So you were in business for how long in that spot?
14 years at that location. And and it just, it's heartbreaking. Like, I mean, that's what literally allowed the life that I have today, was that location. So,
and yesterday you had to close it down and lay everyone off.
Yeah. Everybody who was maybe even going to come back after the initial round of layoffs back in March, there's no chance of that staff ever coming back. We're going to do our best to, as things reopen for the rest of our locations, to bring back as many of them as possible. But the reality is for this foreseeable future, the business levels will not allow us to have more than maybe 50, 60% of our total staff globally between all of our locations and breweries and whatnot to come back.
Greg, what do you say to that?
Well, it's funny because I was just having a conversation about an hour ago with a good friend of mine who owns a car dealership up here. And we were talking about what we've all gone through, and we survived. We've been here for 21 years, and we've survived a recession and the real estate crisis and meat shortages and prices increases going through the roof and margins being razor thin and surviving all that. And nobody would have ever thought that what would close our restaurants potentially is a global pandemic. I mean, that's just not something that you learn about in business school or you plan on. Gabe, obviously being open for 14 years is way past the norm. To have something like this come in, it's heartbreaking. Probably 25% of my staff has been with me the entire time. And in fact, there's a lot of our staff that I'm now employing their kids. Restaurants are such a part of, I guess, the fabric of a community, as opposed to some of the retail shops that are just, kind of nationwide chains. Gabe and I are kind of mom and poppers. We are part of it. We're involved in the community. We're involved in charities. And, it really is. It's heartbreaking. And we were having a record-setting year up until March. And when we shut down, we had to do a left turn and do nothing but takeout for 3 months. And we're a steakhouse, casual fine dining. And our food doesn't lend itself, our menu doesn't lend itself very well to takeout. So we had to start kind of reinventing our menu that would do that. We do a lot of mesquite grilled stuff. We do sea bass and halibut. And that's just not really good takeout stuff. That's something you want to sit down and enjoy at a table with good service, good ambiance. So we had to go ahead and do that, and then, all of a sudden, it's kind of, we're lurching forward. We're open, but we're, open to 60%, and then we're back back down closed to outdoor dining only. And as the governor said yesterday, it's at least 3 weeks. So I don't know what to tell my staff, what's going to happen after 3 weeks.
And that's what they said in March when they first shut us all down. Oh, this will be at least 3 weeks, and then we'll see. So every time, a government official talks about 3 weeks, I'm at this point in time in my head expecting this just to be the new norm. And if the curve doesn't start bending, my expectation is that just as quickly as they brought us back to, I guess, stage 2.5, we're going to be back at stage 2.
Yeah.
Or 1.5.
Right. I mean, the bars weren't open long enough to have caused this spike. Right. So this spike was occurring prior to, and these cases were coming on board prior to, the bar is opening. And so it makes you wonder, like, it's not that it's a knee-jerk reaction. I mean, and it's a necessary reaction, but you gotta, I don't know. My feeling is that, you know, the curve isn't going to bend just because the bars and restaurants are a little bit shut down, you know, or to only outdoor dining. They're going to have to do more.
So what do you think they should do? What do you think the governor should do?
I guess my problem with the whole situation is just like Gabe said, there's no way that opening restaurants and bars could have caused this huge spike. And we seem to be taking the brunt of this. I don't know if the officials are scared to death of 4th of July weekend because it's a long weekend and it's a holiday and people get together. But the restaurants are the only things that are kind of shut back down, where everybody else is kind of the same. The economics are, you know, people kind of poo-poo the economics, but the bars and restaurants that just opened a week ago that just bought all of their product for big opening,
right, I know,
to get back into business is now going to be wasted. I mean, all the fresh produce, the meat, the poultry, that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
it's gone, and there's no insurance policy that covers that. I'm sure Gabe went through it too, but we were denied numerous times because it doesn't cover the pandemic. And the National Restaurant Association was trying to lobby to say it wasn't the pandemic that shut us down. It was the governmental agencies that shut us down, but that argument didn't work either. So. You need to look a little bit past the economics to what it's doing to families, to communities when this happens. Yes, they need to do things, but I, to be honest, from my viewpoint, I don't think they gave the restaurants and the bar industry enough time to get going to find out if it really works.
Yeah. So you would rather that you would be allowed to remain open for inside dining and make sure that you do it safely, but just stay open.
Absolutely. We spent a lot of money. We put barriers up. We have a lot of booths in our restaurant, and so obviously you can't move the booths. So we put the plastic barricades up between the booths, and that was an expensive project. And did some other things, bought some sanitation stations. So there was a lot of money invested in that. And to be open for a little over a week and a half and then shut it down, there's money in that. There's money in the product that's not going to be able to be used. And it's going to be quite a hit.
Yeah.
What I take exception to is that what we were all told is that sectors were going to open and we were going to do this slowly and we were going to wait. I believe it was 14 days between these things happening. And I don't think there was a single 14-day wait between restaurants opening and then something else opening and then something else opening and then something else opening. And if we're going to have these rules, like if I have to play by rules, well, the government needs to play by the rules that they're setting forth as well. And so if you need to wait 2 to 3 weeks after you open restaurants in some capacity to find out whether or not they are going to be the cause of the spikes, well, then you need to do it. It's unfair for us to have not had the opportunity to prove or disprove that these spikes were going to come from our particular segment of the industry. On top of which, again, I will keep banging the drum for this. There needs to be testing and rapid testing for people who have to go to work and be in customer service. And that is grocery store, restaurant, bar workers, taxi drivers, any frontline workers, obviously, where we have the priority to get these rapid tests. Like right now, if you go into Long Beach or even in Orange County and try and get a test right now today, you're probably not going to be able to get one, and it most likely won't be a rapid one. So if anybody in our industry pops positive, we functionally have to shut down for at least a week, maybe two, by the time your entire staff can get two tests within 3 days to prove that they can come back. That's not tenable either.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. What about your customers? Were they playing by the rules? Here you are being really careful, installing partitions and sanitizing stations, but are your customers wearing masks? Are they washing their hands? Are they staying 6 feet apart?
One of the problems that it kind of puts us in, in a police mode, and we're not policemen. We require everybody wear a mask when they come in, and they can certainly take them off, obviously, when they're sitting down eating and drinking. And they are told that if they get up to go to the restroom or to walk around that they should put the mask on. But I can't be following everybody around on the way to the bathroom to tell them to put on a mask. You cannot have people, more than six people at a table. And we've had people pull up a chair just to talk to you know, a table of six. So now you have a table of seven, theoretically. And, it's tough for me to go up and say, I'm sorry, you can't do that. I think by and large, everybody knows what the rules are, and you know, 99% of the people are following the rules. But it does put us in a difficult kind of a policeman-like situation.
Gabe?
Yeah, I would say the vast majority of people are following the rules. We have them posted everywhere. We offer masks to our customers who come in. We're kind of going on, off of the the initial interaction. So we've moved everything to counter service to minimize the interactions between customers and staff. And so if they come in and they're not wearing a mask and they refuse to wear one, I don't have my staff engage anymore. They're not there to have a political discussion about government overreach and tyranny or whatever the latest, argument is for not wearing them. They just don't engage, and we just don't serve.
Okay, final question and a quick answer. How long can you survive at 30% capacity, Greg, and at what, 20% capacity, Gabe? Greg, I'll start with you.
Not very long. Bottom line is at 30%, our restaurant wasn't built to survive at 30%.
Gabe?
Yeah. As a restaurant only, we would not survive, but we are extremely fortunate to have three brewing facilities of our own and have a very large and dedicated fan base of Beechwood Brewing beer. And that is why all of our stores are not closed, even now.
Wow. Thank you both so much, and best of luck to you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Thank you, Madeline. Appreciate it.
Greg Amsler, owner of Salt Creek Grill in Valencia, and Gabe Gordon, owner of Beechwood Barbecue and Brewing in Long Beach. Coming up, where to get good ice cream, even if you can't go inside for a cone.
Fresh peach is legendary this time of year. I mean, who doesn't like an excellent vanilla ice cream studded with fresh peaches?
Evan Kleiman on the best local ice cream next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, Queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bad right there.
Pie.
Time for our weekly Cooking with Evan food segment. And we are days away from the 4th of July weekend. Warmer temperatures are coming our way, which means ice cream. Evan Kleiman has a few tips on where to get the best ice cream. Hi, Evan.
Hi.
Are we talking takeout or delivery when it comes to ice cream these days?
I think most of the places that are doing takeout also do delivery. More places, it seems, are doing only takeout and delivery than in-store. So what I wanted to do was find places that had pints. So it's easy to do. And to me, it's like one of the most luxurious gifts you can share with people.
Yes. And that is a pint per person, I hope.
Which, to me is the appropriate portion.
Definitely. All right. So let's get to your list of recommendations.
So these are all locally founded stores. Everybody knows the bigger names, and I'm sure I've missed some locally founded, but here are the ones that that I could find that I put on the list. Fossilman's, Cool House, Scoops, Bulgarini, Gelateria Uli, Wanderlust, Rory's, Concha Creamery, Ginger's, Antico, which is a restaurant, but they're also making really expensive, wonderful ice cream. Mateo's for paletas. And of course, if you're talking about Persian ice cream, Saffron and Rose.
Okay. Should we get into a couple of them? A couple of the standouts from there?
Yeah. I mean, for me, you know, being the nutball Italian Italophile I am, the two gelateria places that I mentioned, Bogherini and Gelateria Uli, both have really delicious gelato, you know, that super, super smooth texture. Bogherini specializes in outstanding seasonal fruits. I also love their Zabaglione. Gelateria Uli is doing a special July 4th pie with a waffle cone crust, a caramel drizzle, and a speculoos cookie crumble on top. And that comes in various flavor combos. As for the more modern ice cream places with, you know, just a huge range of flavor, Wanderlust has quick become everybody's favorite place. They have a mango sticky rice, which is a marvel, and it's vegan.
Wait, stop right there. Can you really put the word vegan in a sentence that also has ice cream in it?
Okay, so I've eaten this ice cream a couple times, like the entire pint. And I didn't know it was vegan until I started researching for this conversation.
Really? You couldn't tell?
I couldn't tell.
What do they put in it?
I mean, who knows? Coconut milk. It's just, I have no idea. It's just so delicious.
Huh. Okay.
And, you know, people love their other flavors, too. I happened to go by there during the weekend of Juneteenth. And they were doing a special flavor for that. That was just marvelous, weird and wonderful. Rory's is a place that seems to be creeping down the coast from Carpinteria down to Long Beach. People love the malted milk ball from Rory's. And then a place that many people may not know about, Concha Creamery in Gardena. The flavor that really spoke to me, because I love strawberry ice cream, so I tend to use strawberry as a benchmark, is they do a strawberry ice cream with condensed milk, which is just yum.
Ugh, that sounds so good. And may I say, it sounds better than the vegan. I'm sorry,
no, don't,
vegan people.
You must not. I'm telling you, I'm a hard sell, and that was fabulous. And I mean, that was just okay. One flavor. You can get regular ice cream at Wanderlust. Then there's a small place called Ginger's in Culver City. They make ready-to-go sundaes in a jar that are just adorable.
In a jar?
Yeah, they're already in like a ball jar. They put everything together for you, so it's like a sundae to go.
Uh-huh, lovely.
Yeah, really nice. Fosselman's Fresh Peach is legendary this time of year. I mean, who doesn't like an excellent vanilla ice cream studded with fresh peaches? So good.
I am literally drooling right now, literally.
I know. And when I went on the Cool House site, I've always loved Cool House. Their dirty mint chip really like was speaking to me. Dirty because it's made with brown sugar, not white sugar. So like that brown sugar flavor with fresh mint. Oh, that sounds so wonderful. And I have to say about Gelateria Uli, going back to them, is I recently had their yogurt cherry ice cream, and oh my goodness, that was really fabulous.
Do you make your own ice cream?
No. Because I have a very tiny freezer. Like if my freezer is bigger than 1.5 square feet, I would be really surprised. And whenever I did make ice cream, it never was as good as I wanted it to be. Ice cream happens to be one of my maybe top three food groups. And I just love a super smooth fruit-based. I tend to go for fruit. And that's what I'm looking for, except, of course, for that Zabaglione that Bulgarini makes. Oh, unbelievable.
All right. So we'll sit in our backyards and have our own pint of ice cream.
Yeah, and I just encourage people to go out and find one of these places that's near them or maybe a little bit of a drive. Make sure that you have it packed well so it'll get home still frozen. And not just rely on what you can find in the supermarket, because we have all these marvelous shops here in LA making ice cream from scratch. Why not do it?
All right. You can see the list of Evan's recommendations on our homepage at kcrw.com. Evan Kleinman, host of KCRW's Good Food. Happy 4th of July. Happy ice cream eating. Happy summer.
Same to you. I'm going to think of you while I'm going ooh and ah by myself.
Thanks, Evan.
Bye, Madeline.
Coming up, Catherine Deneuve, Hamilton, two reasons to stay inside this weekend. Movie reviews next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. If you were never able to score Hamilton tickets, well, you are in luck. It's now available for streaming. Two critics are here to talk about it. William Bibbiani, film critic and co-host of the podcasts Canceled Too Soon and the critically acclaimed network is here. Hi, Bibbs.
Hello.
And Katie Walsh reviews films for the Tribune News Service and the LA Times. Hi, Katie.
Hey.
All right. Well, let's get Hamilton out of the way now or just wallow in its glory. This is the stage recording of Lin-Manuel Miranda's hit Broadway musical available on Disney Plus. And here's a clip of the trailer.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show.
The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder by being a lot smarter by being a self-starter.
This is Hamilton.
Okay, Katie, Lin-Manuel himself is playing Hamilton in this version that was recorded, I believe, back in 2016. So what do you think?
I never saw Hamilton on stage. So, you know, got to say, this Hamilton plays pretty good. Don't know if you heard that, but...
I think I've heard that song about 1,000 times, even though I've never seen it on stage.
Right. And I got in bed after watching it and the songs were like stuck in my head for hours.
Yeah.
So catchy and so wordy and dense. And, you know, I think even if you know the songs and have memorized the soundtrack as my niece and nephew have, there's just something about seeing it on stage that just really drives the impact home. And the performances are so fantastic. It's kind of fun to sort of go back in time and see David Diggs and see Leslie Odom Jr. and Renee Elise Goldsberry and just say, oh my God, they're such rock stars. And mm-hmm. just really enjoy, you know, the full experience of it.
Bibbs, did you see the play?
I saw the Los Angeles production of the play and it was stellar. But seeing it with the original cast and seeing some slight variations on how the characters were played and the staging really, I think, opens up the play a lot. You know, this is a filmed production of the play. This is not a feature film adaptation where they like went to real locations or anything. And as a result, all of that original choreography is intact. But because it's cinema, we actually get to get closer up to the actors and we get to get a better sense, I think, than ever before of just what an incredible performance a lot of these actors are giving in addition to putting on a fabulous show. Leslie Odom Jr. is giving just an absolutely astounding performance in particular. I was completely captivated by him in this version. I was very curious because this is on Disney Plus. Whether some of the more raunchy aspects of the play would remain intact. And if you're familiar with it, even if you just only heard the soundtrack, you know that there is some swearing, there is references to, you know, sex. It's really embedded into the narrative. You can't remove it even if you wanted to. And I'm pleased to report that they kept pretty much everything in. There is one expletive that is beeped, but I think it is for comedic effect. It doesn't feel particularly, you know, hurtful or painful. There might be some questions you're kids have about certain scenes if you decide to watch this as a family, like, hey, let's watch this American history play, because mm-hmm. it's actually, you know, really dense with history and information and some but not all of the less flattering aspects of Hamilton's life. You know, Hamilton, of course, is the story of one of the founding fathers whose story didn't get told very often. And Lin-Manuel Miranda wanted to do a musical that explored this different perspective on American history. And he wanted to do it through people of a cast of people of color. And, you know, there are some elements of Hamilton's life that just the play just doesn't tackle because it would make him look really, really bad. So my thing is, I always recommend, you know, you use something like Hamilton as a launching pad to learn more about history, and maybe don't take all of your history from it. But if this is new to you, Hamilton is absolutely a revelation. It's musically brilliant. The staging is fantastic. And I do think it's a must see. And it's really exciting that finally, after all of these years where the tickets were, you know, an astoundingly expensive ticket,
you have to that's subscribe to Disney Plus.
They've democratized Hamilton. Well, but that's still so much cheaper, though. You know, like for $10, $12, you can see Hamilton. And if that's all you wanted, you can just cancel Disney Plus right then and there. You just saved hundreds of dollars on a Hamilton ticket.
Well, you know, Hamilton himself was the first Secretary of the Treasury, right? So maybe he would approve. I don't know. He came up with our banking system, after all.
Yeah.
So there's some justice there. All right, let's move on to Metamorphosis. This is a Korean horror film out on Shudder, and the trailer's in Korean, so I won't play it. But Bibbs, you saw this, and what did you think?
Well, anyone who knows me knows I'm a big horror fan, and the horror genre is really fascinating right now, and there's some really amazing stuff coming out of South Korea. Metamorphosis is an interesting possession thriller. It starts off with an exorcism, very much like what you might have seen at the end of the movie The Exorcist, and then it goes off in a new direction in which the priest who fails to save a young woman from a demonic possession has to... The demon starts going after his own family, but what happens is it doesn't just possess one person. It will randomly possess different members of the family and have them start behaving abusively to everyone else in order to rip apart the family from the inside. So it's a new take on an old horror convention. And when this movie is focusing on this nightmarish quality where you've got a family, everyone's got their baggage, everyone's got their buttons that are being pushed, and then just one person is all of a sudden the kind of person who might turn violent at the drop of a hat, and you never know who it is or what the trigger will be. That's something that actually I think is really insidiously terrifying. I think
sounds like a good allegory for the virus.
It's good because we're all stuck together. I also think it's an effective allegory for anyone who's had someone in their family who had a hair trigger temper or was abusive, and so horror is always a really powerful way to explore aspects of the human experience that make us uncomfortable. The only thing with the movie is that occasionally it gets really stupid. Like, there's this good chunk in the middle, which is as scary as any horror movie I've seen this year. And then it's bookended by these really big opening and this really big ending that just get broader and sillier and crazier. And I will say this, I was never not entertained.
Really?
It's fun. I had a good time watching it. It's entertaining at the beginning. It's entertaining at the ending. It's genuinely scary in the middle. So there's an inconsistency to this. However, you know, I think the horror genre is a sort of genre where people can be really forgiving about that. Some people are looking at it only for entertainment value. Some people are looking only to be scared. This movie does offer both. And I think the actual like pattern of going from broad to serious to broad makes it feel a little bit like a roller coaster. Now, you may laugh at scenes that are supposed to be scary here and there because characters are doing things that are obviously not in their best interest. There's a whole thing where basically the demon never seems to be anyone who's in the room. It's always like whoever leaves the room will come back as a demon. So why would anyone ever leave the room? And you're
because
watching the
you're
horror
so
movie.
You're so sick of being quarantined. You have to get
out. Exactly.
No matter what happens.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, this is something that I think we're starting to notice. Like, there's this whole eye-rolling post-scream detachment from horror movies. Like, oh, why would someone do something that is obviously not in the interest of their personal safety just because they want to? That's stupid. No one would do that. Apparently, that's a thing. Yeah,
Apparently,
all have to be a lot more forgiving about horror movies now, I think. And so Metamorphosis is one of the first films I've seen post that revelation. And so, yeah, I'm very entertained by this. There's a lot of really good original films on Shudder lately. And this is definitely an entertaining one if you're starving for the kind of horror movies that, you know, you could like spill your popcorn or whatever and like go to see in a theater. This is a very, very good, not amazing, it's not going to make my best films of the year, but this is a very entertaining horror film that I do recommend for fans of the genre.
Okay, that's Metamorphosis. It's out on Shudder. Finally, let's talk about The Truth, the movie that is called The Truth. This stars Ethan Hawke, Juliette Binoche, and Catherine Deneuve, the film, mostly in French, but there's just enough English to hear in this clip from the trailer.
I don't remember.
You were just a baby.
And you, Daddy?
No, I've never been here before.
The house looks like a castle.
It does.
Yes, even though there's a prison just behind it.
Welcome.
You wanted to make her jealous. Show her our happy family, but that's not gonna make her jealous.
Okay, Katie, you saw this one, and this is one of those mother-daughter come to mama or don't come to mama movies where it's the battle axe mom and the daughter who wants to have a relationship with her, and what happens?
Yes, that is a very good sort of distillation of what's going on in this film, but it's also a film that is really about the truth and how everyone sort of has different versions of it and memory and storytelling. And this is also a film that's very much about storytelling and filmmaking and is very sort of referential to who Juliette Binoche and Catherine Deneuve are. So Catherine Deneuve plays a legendary French actress, and she is making a film at the time that Juliette Binoche, her daughter, and her family come and visit her to discuss this memoir that she's just written called The Truth. And her daughter is a writer, and she has a lot of fact-checking that she does with the memoir. But at the same time, Fabienne, the actress, is acting in this film about a mother and a daughter, and it's sort of a sci-fi film where a mother keeps leaving every 2 years to go to space to save her life. And so she doesn't age, but her daughter keeps aging. So it's about, you know, a mother coming in and out of a daughter's life. And it's a very similar situation, I think, that Lumiere, the Juliette Binoche character, feels with her own mother. And this is directed by Hirokazu Koreeda, who did Shoplifters, which was nominated for an Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film a couple of years ago. And I just think he has such a ability to create an effortless world that you can kind of just slip into. And even though there's tension among the family, there's a real warmth to the environment and the setting.
And you can't get better than Catherine Deneuve when it comes to the queen of French cinema.
I mean, there's no one else. And this is a fantastic performance from Catherine Deneuve, because she's playing a version of herself, I have to assume, but she's this very imperious sort of star who's sort of waited on by all of these men in her life. And it's kind of her journey to sort of like learning a little bit of gratitude and humility and how to love her daughter. But at the same time, she's like always going to be Fabienne d'Angeville, and sort of like, how do you navigate what it means to have your mother be Catherine Deneuve, or, you know, a version of Catherine Deneuve. And
how do you navigate being Catherine Deneuve when you're in your 70s as Catherine Deneuve?
Exactly. And a lot of it is her sort of reckoning with her past and relationships that she had with other actresses. I mean, there's a really funny sequence where she starts talking about all these great actresses whose names were alliterative. So she's going on and on, like, Aimee Anouk or Anouk Aimee and Greta Garbo. And then someone says Bridget Bardot and she's like, whatever.
Like a little inside joke. Yeah.
Yeah. Inside jokes and references that like you have to love.
All right. That is the truth. And that's a great way to end the segment and to wish you a bon weekend, both of you.
Merci.
Yes, merci beaucoup. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay. A tout à l'heure. William Bibbiani, film critic and co-host of the podcast Cancel Too Soon and the critically acclaimed network. And Katie Walsh is film critic for the Tribune News Service and the Los Angeles Times. And that's it for Press Play for today and this week. Tomorrow we have a special broadcast of an episode of the KCRW podcast, Welcome to LA. Our producers are Rosalie Atkinson, Brian Hardzinski, Angie Perrin, and Kaylee Wells. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Amy Ta is our digital producer. Mario Saavedra and Phil Richards are our technical directors. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a happy and safe holiday weekend. I'll see you on Monday.